Welcome to KSL Radio Afternoon Show with Amy Donaldson from the Deseret News and my compadre.
Hi, Amy. This is State Representative Steve Handy. We're back.
Yes,
they've got us on again.
Yes, they let us have access
why?
To the room. I think this might be our swan song.
It might be.
I hear
got
Lee.
Got a new schedule going on starting next week with Lee Lonsberry.
Lee Lonsberry is going to. I think his debut is actually Wednesday, okay. So you have a couple more days of Doug Wright. So savor those and be excited about the new show.
But, great stuff.
You know,
but
we'll
happy
still
to be here
around.
Today. And it's sunny outside.
Yeah, very momentarily. Nice. We can momentarily see blue sky. We welcome Robin to our
hello
to the news quiz.
Yes,
what do you have for us today,
Robin Garfield?
I'm live in the studio. Yes, I've got some headlines as usual. I'm going to read these off, and the two of you can just respond. You know, give me your hot takes.
Okay.
The first one is topical because it's the Christmas season, and it appears to be the headline was "Where is my Amazon package? It may be late." Turns out Amazon is already having trouble getting packages to shoppers on time. If either one of you, are you, first off, are you big Amazon users?
I'm not a big Amazon user, but I have already had, I order some of my dog's long-term medication through Amazon, and it's already slower. Mm. So what I used to get in 24 hours has, the last time I ordered it was 3 days.
Huh. You know, I don't have any orientation to that. I mean, we're occasional Amazon, and we'll have to see. I mean, some things are going to happen, but boy, I sure see their trucks all over my neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a Prime member. So you are as well.
I'm a bit of an addict. Yeah, we have an Amazon problem in our house. Stuff comes when you remember ordering.
Who ordered it?
It's a quick swipe and it shows up. Yeah, so look out there because packages might be late. The second headline, I actually talked to a friend yesterday who worked in a victims advocacy program about this, and it's really troubling. Uber reported more than 3,000 sexual assaults in 2018 alone.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot for one company. Have either one of you read the story or have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, and I actually stopped using Uber because of the way they handled sexual harassment claims from their drivers and people within their company. So I switched to Lyft, and then Lyft had some similar issues. But some of the issues were the drivers sexually harassing, molesting, or assaulting their passengers. And so one thing I thought was helpful that women, and sadly, were sharing ways in which you could keep yourself safe. Like when you order an Uber or a Lyft, you get a license plate number and you get the driver's name. And so when somebody comes up and says, hey, are you waiting for Uber or Lyft? Then you say, who are you here to pick up? Right? So
they have them say your
they
name.
Have to give you your information. Mm-hmm. And just little things like that. I let people know. I take pictures. I send a picture to somebody, one of my girlfriends or my kids. Mm-hmm. This is the Lyft I'm getting in. So, I mean, it's not going to prevent something from happening, but at least there's a chance that you could catch them afterwards. So, yeah. I mean, it's sad that this is the universe in which women live and probably some men, but mostly it's women who are being victimized in this way because it's such an amazing development. I love Lyft, especially when I'm traveling. It's such a much easier, cheaper way to get around.
Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, it's horribly, horribly disturbing. It's outrageous behavior that this marvelous, as Amy said, this marvelous disruptive technology or you know, way to get around it. It is terrific. When it works, it just works great. But it's just incredibly disturbing. They've got to do a better job screening these drivers. And when these things happen, they've got to stand behind their customers, not their drivers.
Yeah, it's Lyft and Uber are wonderful things. They are. It is just a little. I commuted last year when we lived in the Bay Area. I took a flight every Tuesday from San Francisco I took a class at UCLA and had to take an Uber to the campus and back to the airport. And that was a midnight Uber drive once a week in LA. It was a little nerve wracking, but you can share your ride, so my husband could follow my progress. So you know if anything stopped or weird or anything happened. But for 10 weeks, two Uber, you know, there and back to the airport. Yeah, I had that weird feeling of just in a car with a stranger. I was always told don't get in a car with a stranger.
Well, and you're actually ordering the car and saying, I am by myself and I am at your mercy, right? So all the things that you're kind of cautioned against, saying, hey, here I am, I'm vulnerable, especially like you say, those late night, if you work nights, it's a tough one to solve for women. You can now request a gender driver. Mm-hmm. So if you want to I've actually requested a lot of women drivers.
That's a good innovation. I like that. I didn't know that.
And I don't know that Uber has that, but Lyft allows you to say, I would like a female driver.
Yeah. I never had a scary experience. If you talk to me and drive, I'm going to not give you a great review. I like quiet Uber rides.
I love to chat.
At midnight, I was exhausted. I was like, please just drive me to the airport.
Oh, I basically interview the people who drive me.
Sometimes it's fun, but sometimes I'm like, okay, just turn it off. Yeah. Okay, here's the next one. I have a question for you about both of you about this issue, because we're talking air quality, which is, there's just such a throwing spaghetti at the wall with this. So poor air quality forces kids inside for school recess here in Salt Lake. What I wanted to ask both of you, during the mayoral campaign and all the political campaigns, the big thing is we're going to fix the air. Is it, how much of a percentage, or could you break it down between just pure geography, it's stuff that we can't fix because of inversion and lake effect, and policy? Steve?
Well, I know a lot about this. I've been working on air quality things in my multiple years in the legislature, and people don't want to hear what I'm going to say right now, but the air is cleaner overall than it has been the last 10 years. I mean, it is cleaner. We have these terrible inversions, and even I have felt the last 2 days an effect upon me. And we've always had these inversions. Let's remember that. We've always had these inversions. We can't move the mountains, but
there's more people.
Our population has grown. We're driving more. One of the great things that's coming is the refineries just to the north of us here going to have this Tier 3 cleaner low-sulfur gasoline. That's going to be available here in January, and that, as that takes hold, that's going to be very helpful. So it's something we're going to just have to live with, but we've all got to take a greater responsibility in reducing our driving, moving, transitioning to cleaner vehicles.
Here's the issue I have, that if I want to ride my bike or walk somewhere instead of driving, which I can do because a lot of communities now are walkable communities, I have to suck in this air. And so that's the kind of catch-22 we're in now. Is that it isn't, there are things you can do. I mean, I would just say one thing is stop using drive-thrus. So, it's not going to solve every problem, but you can walk in a place. Now, there are people who need a drive-thru. Maybe they're in a wheelchair and they're stopping to get medications at the Walgreens or whatever. There are people who have to use a drive-thru. You have small children or some reason that you can't get out of your car. Leave the drive-thru for people who have to use it. And then you get out of your car and go in the store if you can. I think just little things like that, as far as the air quality goes. Because just walking, I got a horrible chest. Like, my chest hurts so bad just from walking to the gym.
Yeah, to the gym. And, you know, I'm on the board of what's called Utah Clean Cities. And we've had a campaign that we kick off with the governor, everything yet that you're. And it's this little teeny tiny phrase. Be idle free. Turn the key.
I know, but nobody does it.
Nobody does it.
Well,
We have some ordinances where you can. The cities can put a little ordinance in with, a little bit of, governance.
If my poor husband's listening, which he's probably picking up the kids right now from school, so thank you, honey. If you're listening, he let the car idle in the driveway last week to warm it up, and I gave him, we just moved here from California. Yeah, I'm like, you know better than this. I gave him such a hard time for that.
That's not
He's like, it's just the one time. It was so cold outside, and I said, you're part of the, anyway.
Not necessary to do that.
So there you heard it,
Turn the key, be idle free.
All right, I have one other quick question, because all week when I've been on with Doug, I'm asking one fluffy Christmas question, because it is December, and I love Christmas more than just about anything in the world. So, Steve and Amy, what is your favorite holiday song? Christmas, holiday, anything to do with winter?
That's easy for me. Oh, Holy Night.
That's
my favorite song.
One.
Steve.
Well, you have to go with the with Silent Night. You have to go with Silent Night. I have some affinity for Germany and Switzerland, and so that's really a very moving thing.
So you both went deep. My favorite one is "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas" sung by Judy Garland.
Oh, and
but those are both
more contemporary than a really old traditional Christmas hymnal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have Yourself a Merry Little
Christmas. And anything off the Elvis Christmas album.
Well,
wow.
Silver Bells always reminds me of my grandmother, so I like that one a lot, too.
Sung by Elvis.
Yes,
a good version.
It is. It's an awesome version.
I am teaching my children. We played it last week when we were decorating the tree. That album, for me, reminds me of everything wonderful in the world. Elvis is Christmas.
For me, it's all the little kid ones. I want to have Eponymous for Christmas. Those ones that when I go to my grandkids' program, they sing. Those are the ones I'm
good for about one listening to that a year. One, any more than that, and it starts getting a little bit into my temples.
Then there's all that great favorite, Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
That is an awesome.
My
song.
Husband taught the kids that on the guitar. They were singing that the other night, like the Von Trapps.
So the easier question is, which one do you hate? And I'll tell you straight up, it's 12 Days of Christmas.
It goes
I hate
on forever.
That song. I don't want to hear it. I don't think it
I hate the, both the Paul McCartney and the John Lennon two songs. They're horrible.
There's one called My Christmas Wish or something. It's very poppy. I don't know.
Oh.
I don't love
the
one that
about
one.
Is it the one with the shoes?
No, the Christmas shoes is a whole different ballgame. No, that one definitely. But there's one like My Special Christmas Wish for You, May There Be World Peace. It's a sweet song. It just, it's too saccharine for me. But those two, you said Oh Holy Night and Silent Night. Those are beautiful.
Yeah.
Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is one of my favorite. All right. We are done. Amy, tell us what's coming up in the next segment or coming up on the show today.
Okay. Well, we actually have a lot of really interesting things, I think. But we're going to talk about... Utah Heart Association is going to join us to talk about some innovations with vaping and vaping education. We're going to talk about domestic violence and what's being done to protect victims. And we're also going to talk about Pearl Harbor and plastic bags and the Utes playing for the championship in California. Welcome back into KSL Radio. Again, I'm Amy Donaldson.
I'm Steve Handy.
And
here we are.
Yeah, we're going to talk about vaping. And we know there's been a bunch of discussion about it. But
right,
we're bringing somebody in from the Utah Heart Association, Mark Watterson. I guess they're having a summit. And, you know, I have some questions about just sort of how they're going to reach the kids with this education aspect. Mark, are you with us?
I am. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for
How you doing, Mark? Yeah. Let's talk about this. When I was asked to guest host, looked at an email that I got from you in the last couple of days about a very interesting, looked like a very, I'm going to say, in-depth and meaty summit that's coming up in January. You've got a lot of things. So tell us why the Heart Association would get involved in this very serious issue and what's new about it? You just sent me some information about some CDC statistics, and tell us about that, Mark.
Yeah, no, for the Heart Association, our mission is helping everyone to live the healthiest lives possible, and that especially applies for our youth. And you know, one of the most concerning things that we are seeing out there right now is unfortunately this youth vaping epidemic that's going on. I had sent some information to you. I'd be happy to share that.
Go ahead, please.
With your listeners.
Please. Yeah.
In 2009, in the state of Utah, our youth tobacco use was less than 5%. And by many, statistics, we felt like we almost had this issue, completely wiped out. And then e-cigarettes came on the scene. In 2011, when vaping nicotine, started to become a popular thing or just started to hit the scene, it jumped up to 3% of high school students. In 2013, it was 8%. In 2015, it jumped up to 13%. This year, we're up to 16% of our high school students that are actively vaping these nicotine products. That's more than 1 in 6 high school students just here in the state of Utah. You want to talk about average class size.
Six kids in
every classroom in our high schools that are addicted to these nicotine products. This is a huge issue. And, I realize that this is something that, KSL has been great to to help get the word out and spread the information, but we continue to get this information out and hope that others will help us because it's a problem that's only getting worse.
Okay.
The CDC just released information yesterday with their National Youth Tobacco Survey. We have 6 million high school students across the United States that are addicted to nicotine. Using these vaping devices. That's more than 1 in 4 high school students nationwide. When you consider a decade ago that we felt like we almost had tobacco usage wiped among our youth, and now 1 in 4 high school students nationwide are using these, it's a really big issue.
Incredibly alarming, incredibly alarming.
Yeah.
Amy has
a
question,
Mark,
for you.
Mark, I have a question about, how do you reach the kids, though? Because I think I see parents getting upset and more educated. Obviously, a lot of parents did not know what vaping was or what e-cigarettes were. I think there's been a ton of education in the last few months. But how do you reach kids and does a message with, is there any message that resonates with them?
No, that's a great question. And something that within just the last week, our organization actually nationwide kicked off a new social media campaign. You know, when you consider trying to reach someone, you gotta try and meet them where their eyes and their attention are. And for our youth, it's in their phones. And so we have a great new youth initiative called hashtag Quit Lying, in which we're going after these tobacco companies that for years talked about, hey, you know, these vaping products, they're harmless. It's just water vapor. And we know now for a fact that that's not the case. And so we're really trying to push this new, you know, social media initiative to really try and get kids' attention to just the health impacts that this is going to have for the rest of their lives. Not to mention the, you know, the way that nicotine completely messes up the.
Uh-oh, maybe did we lose him, Mamie?
Uh-oh,
Did he say? They'll try to get him back. Did they say hashtag quit lying?
I think it's quit lying, L-I-N-E, hashtag quit lying. Or quit lying? Is it lying?
Quit lying? It might be quit lying. We have to double check.
I'll check on social media while we discuss this.
Getting back.
To me, that's really the biggest issue because I think there are a lot of things that that kids are struggling with and a lot of things we're trying to help kids make good decisions about,
sure.
Right? So how do we have this conversation with kids in a way that doesn't shut them down or, you know, close them off to us? How do we have like an open dialogue about something like this?
So Mark, you're back.
And that's a great
tell us
point.
That hashtag again.
I mean, so in fact, we'd encourage parents and others to actually go to quitlying.org. So yeah, lying is an L-Y-I-N-G, so
yeah,
quitlying.org. And it's a resource not only for kids, but, you know, scroll down and there's information for educators, for parents, for students, really trying to help facilitate that dialogue. You know, we recognize it's an addiction issue. So as parents, you know, wanting to make sure that you're approaching this not as a, oh, my terrible kid, I'm going to come down, I'm hard on this, but, you know, these kids are struggling, and how can we best help them? The unfortunate part in all this is that, you know, when you talk about tobacco cessation methods, you know, the gum or other FDA-approved things, these are meant for adults. And so the whole industry is now trying to figure out, how do we try and break a 14-year-old from a nicotine addiction? It's just a really unfortunate situation that these tobacco and vaping companies have put our youth in, and now these families that are now struggling with their youth using them.
Mark, we have about a minute, but just tell us quickly. This is terrific, the Heart Association. Just tell us quickly about the summit, who's invited, what you're going to try to accomplish, when it is, et cetera.
No, absolutely. So this is specifically for lawmakers. We're reaching out to superintendents, school administrators, to the youth. We want lawmakers to be able to hear firsthand the experiences that our communities are seeing with this vaping problem. And then we'll also be going over policy recommendations that legislators over the summer came up with, you know, to really try and to solve this issue.
Yeah, I know we're going to see a number of bills.
No silver bullet, but, you know, looking at things like flavors and increasing the age of purchase, all those things are on the table and need to be addressed. So thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to talk about domestic violence and another bill that might be making its way through the legislature.
Yes, we are.
That deals with emergency restraining protective orders. You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio's afternoon show with Amy Donaldson and Steve Handy this week.
Yes, hello.
Sunny Friday afternoon. If you want to join the conversation, we encourage you to do so. We'd love to have your thoughts. Join us on the Utah Community Credit Union text line. You can text your comments to 57500. You can also call in and leave a voicemail. We may read it on air. The call-in line is 801-575-7668. And if you miss anything on the show or you hear us talking about the end of something and you want to hear the beginning of it, you can also download the KSL News Radio app. I recommend it anyway because then you can always listen, even if you're not near a radio. And that's sponsored by Any Hour Services, and we're very grateful for their sponsorship of that because that app is just
amazing. I've used that a lot when traveling. It's awesome.
I know. It is nice when you're not – I've actually even used it on the gym when they've had – especially with all the breaking news that's happened. It's kind of nice to have the app to listen live. I'm very excited about the next couple segments we're going to be talking about. Some things that you've been working on,
like yes,
just sort of fortunate collision of events here. We have Carrie Butler from Action Utah in the studio with us, and we're going to be joined at 1:15 by Chief Gary Giles from Orem. And we're just talking about you want to talk about the bill that you're sponsoring? Or,
this is we're gonna start talking about domestic violence, how we curb that. Carrie's an expert on that and has been working with our friend. You are an expert.
Okay,
Carrie.
Great. And
add that to my CV. But here we are today with two horrific gun violence things. One at Pearl Harbor and one in Florida.
In Pensacola at Naval Base.
It's just unbelievable.
And we don't know all the circumstances to them, but what we know is that when people are in distress, if they have access to a weapon, they tend to do more damage to the people around them and to themselves. And that's one of the things there were some holes in the Safe Harbor law that Action Utah wanted to address. And you're working with the Domestic Violence Coalition and law enforcement really to address those.
Right. Yeah. So thank you, by the way, for having me on. So let me talk a little bit about the Safe Harbor law, which I think passed a few years ago in the state of Utah.
Yes, it did.
And was amended a little bit last legislative session by Representative Malloy. This is a bill that allows a person who feels like they might be in crisis and doesn't have anywhere else to put their firearms to take those firearms to law enforcement to hold on to. Last year, it was amended to include family members who could also take that firearm from the person if they felt safe enough to do so and turn it into the law enforcement. And this year, it was kind of brought to our attention that there were a few holes in that that made it kind of hard to enforce.
Give me an example of
for example, I think that there's a line in there prohibits law enforcement to hold on to that firearm if somebody comes to look for it. And Chief Giles will be able to talk a little bit more.
Oh, so if they come and say, "I need my gun back," you have to give it back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So regardless of
the circumstance,
which is great if you're not in crisis, but if you are in crisis and you haven't gotten the services you need to kind of stabilize yourself, then that becomes problematic. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that it's entirely voluntary, which misses this entire population of people. It's not a huge population. It's actually quite small and narrow, but a population of people who maybe, number one, don't realize they're in crisis, and number two, haven't intersected anywhere with the behavioral or mental health system and or the criminal justice system. In order to be able to intervene and separate them temporarily from their firearms, which is why we're super excited that Representative Handy is going to be running his bill, which kind of closes those gaps a little bit this legislative session.
Now, I've actually run into this in my personal life where I had a friend who was having some mental health issues and was worried about having weapons in the house, but also worried about telling police because they didn't want to have those weapons confiscated. And so they gave them to a friend who held on to them. But I just wonder, like, is that maybe one of the issues? Like, how do you handle this if it is voluntary or if you are, like, you're in crisis, you know that, but you don't know how deep you're into it?
Right. So I think that that's one of the gold standard, right, is you recognize yourself or you have a loved one or a family member around you who recognizes that you're in crisis and can hold those firearms for you. Now, that's what we hope will always happen. And we know that that doesn't always happen. Not everybody has that ability and not everybody is surrounded by family members who are capable because of, you know, the nuances of family relationships to be able to do that. And this is a mechanism which law enforcement or a family member might have to be able to intervene a little more forcefully and not criminally so that we can get the person the help that they need.
I think that's the key. It's like, how do you deal with this? And I think the thinking is if I call and ask for help from police, then it's automatically going to be a big mess.
Right.
We're talking about criminal records and people going to jail and maybe never getting the weapons back. And so is there some level of in between that you can use law enforcement for, or is there somebody else you need to call?
Well, now what's happening here is that we wade into a very important constitutional issue, and that is the Second Amendment. And we're trying to weave a very careful and thread a very careful needle here that we protect a constitutional right to keep and bear arms with this proliferation of gun violence that any responsible gun owner wants to prohibit in responsible ways. Mm-hmm. We have to look for legal, responsible ways. And there are gaps in the law, as you were pointing out, and you and Carrie were talking here, Amy. There are gaps in the law that we'll have Chief Giles on here in a minute. You can do what's called pink slip a person, but that's a temporary removal. That's mm-hmm. another option, another tool in toolbox. So we have the safe harbor issue that we've been talking
which
about.
Which is a great tool.
Which is a great, great tool.
As far
tool.
As you can use it.
And I know personally about this because my father now passed. He was an attorney. And I know a couple of situations where clients would bring their a son's gun. This is one I remember that I went to visit my dad, and here were these firearms stacked in the corner. I said, "What are those?" Well, they brought these because their son was going to do harm to himself, and he held them temporarily. That it wasn't a confiscation, and so those things can happen. And this can also happen with safe harbor, that you can take it to the police station, mm-hmm. but they can't hold them. There's nothing that says whether the person is in a better state of mind, a better mental state to responsibly own and use their firearms. And that's what these extreme risk protective orders that we'll eventually talk about here in our conversation. That's what they are designed to do. 17 states plus the District of Columbia have them. They have all been upheld by constitutional challenges, under constitutional challenges. They are constitutional because a judge gives the order for a temporary confiscation, removal. Confiscation sounds terrible, but removal. And then the person appears in court. They try to get the person some help. And Carrie, you and I both know that this is the last straw.
Right.
The yep. last straw that a family member would employ
right.
before they do this, mm-hmm. before they have petitioned the courts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The hope is that, again, the gold standard is that somebody can intervene long before this ever happens and get the person the help that they yeah. need. Now, I think something that is really important and that you kind of touched on a little bit, Amy, with your friend's experience is that people don't want to intersect with the criminal system at
right.
all. Now, this is a civil procedure. And I think something that is really important to talk about when we're talking about Second Amendment rights is that once a person commits a crime with a firearm now, or commits harm with that firearm and yeah. survives that, that person then becomes a permanently prohibited person, permanently.
Right.
Now, if you intervene with something like a red flag or something like safe harbor and prevent that person and get that person the help that they need, once they have experienced the help and once they have come through their crisis, they can have their firearms back and they're restored to full rights under the law, which we think is really interesting
yeah.
as far as the Second Amendment protections go.
And I think that's going to be critical
in
talking to the public yeah. about this mm-hmm. because that's the whole idea is like how can I get help for somebody that I love or care about but not ruin their life, but
right.
not take something right. from them that maybe they feel they need in their life, either
right.
for protection or for recreation. And like you said, it's just a fundamental right. Some people just want it.
Oh, yeah.
Even if they never,
right.
Actually use it. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to bring Chief Giles into this conversation. Again, you can join us on the Utah Community Credit Union text line, 57500. You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. I am Amy Donaldson alongside Steve Handy.
Yeah, happy to be here. We're at it again, Amy.
One of our favorite representatives.
We're at it again.
We are. We're causing trouble and taking names. We've dragged Carrie Butler from Action Utah into our melee. And we're going to be joined this segment by Chief Gary Giles from Orem PD. Can you hear me, Chief?
I can.
Oh,
welcome.
Thank you
Hello
so
there,
much.
Chief. Yeah.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Chief
thank
Giles.
Good to be here.
Let's start with you this segment. And will you just give us some idea of, I think I should say, 40% of homicides in the state of Utah last year were domestic violence related homicides, and the vast majority of those involved a firearm. What is it like for officers responding to a domestic violence call?
I'll tell you what, the domestic violence calls are probably the
highest, some of the highest risk calls that, that law enforcement officers respond to in their, you know, on a day-to-day basis. In fact, we respond to family problems all the time. Some involve violence, some don't, but those can be the most dangerous that we respond to because of the high emotions that are involved. You know, you have children involved, marriages, relationships, and it just becomes very dangerous for us. And so you rarely see fewer than two or three officers respond to a call. Even when we don't know that there's violence going on, we want to respond with several officers because of the risk to us as well as to others.
Yeah, and we were just talking offline about the number of suicides. You have 660 suicides in Utah last year. Half of those involved a firearm. Like, what role do you see law enforcement playing in like, if I call and say, hey, my dad, I think he's suicidal. He has a couple guns in the house. Like, what role does law enforcement play? Or is that a 100% civil situation?
Well, no, law enforcement plays a big role in that, and it is a lot of it is civil. But we still play a huge role in that, and we could probably do an entire show on
yeah,
law
we could.
Enforcement and mental health.
Yeah, we could.
Departments, including my department, Orem. I have two full-time mental health officers. That's all they do is follow up on calls of when people are suicidal. They deal with those on a daily basis, and we do the follow-up. We have several social workers that work with us, interns and so forth. You know, that is a big topic in law enforcement right now because we do get called when someone is suicidal, and where law enforcement comes into play in that is a couple things. Is one is we are kind of the portal that can do what we call a pink slip, which is an emergency application for a commitment, a temporary commitment. So we could take somebody down to a local mental health authority and fill out this pink slip, and basically it's a request with what cause, you know, we write out what cause we have that we want them to evaluate this person and hold them temporarily. But we're kind of that portal to get them to that location. If it's not to a doctor or other means, the law enforcement is that portal to get them there.
Yeah, and Chief, I have a personal, from a friend of mine, this is a personal experience where the spouse was pink-slipped. The spouse was pink-slipped. Went to a behavioral at the hospital and transported by the police, got out in a day or two, something like that, got access again to her firearm, and on the phone with her spouse, she shot herself. And tragic, which is, so we're going to now compare and contrast with an extreme risk protective order, as you understand it and as I understand it, and Carrie, we want to help the listeners understand it. What would the difference be here now if we had one of these in place in the state of Utah?
Well, the difference, I think the biggest thing that people need to understand is that first of all, what being suicidal is not a criminal offense.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And so we're not arresting someone to get them the mental health that they need. All we are doing is trying to be that portal, like I say, to the mental health authority. Once they're into that, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't diagnose anyone. I can only get them the help to the people that can help them. Now, can they get out within 24 hours? I could tell you story after story, like what you just said. Through a 27-year career, I've seen a lot of those kind of situations.
Right.
And the difference in that being that it's not a criminal offense, as the government, as the police officers, we don't have the authority to go in and take that gun or remove that gun from that person. From their firearms while they get that help that they need. And that's the difference is because it's not criminal, I can't take it as evidence. I can't go into the home and remove it. We do have what's called a safe harbor law, but in the way it's currently written, it really has no effect because it has to basically what's called the owner cohabitant, which what I would interpret that to be would be the person that we're dealing with or worried about. They have to voluntarily bring it to the police department and turn it over to us, and that's rarely ever going to happen.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so how does this play into that extreme risk protective order, Carrie?
Well, and I haven't seen the wording on extreme risk protective order yet as far as here in the state of Utah, but the way that it's done, and I know it's very controversial. A lot of people, you know, gun rights advocates, they want there to be a very due process in this. The problem, and I've had to really do some self-reflection on this because I am a gun rights advocate.
Of course you are.
But I've had to do a lot of self-reflection on this, because in a 27-year career, I do have some personal experience in this, in that 1 year and about a week ago, my nephew shot and killed himself.
Oh.
And I don't know that there necessarily was a situation that somebody saw this coming. He had some roommates, but if by any means somebody could have gotten that gun and separated him from that, and there's any chance that he would still be here today, that I would have a nephew and that my sister would have a son, it's worth looking into. That's what the conclusion that I've come to is that I think that we've got to do something. What we're currently doing is not working. We have too many suicides in the state of Utah, and unfortunately, the police can't solve everything. But we can't also. We don't want to criminalize it.
No,
they need to be in the criminal system. They need to get help, and they need to get through this. It's a mental illness. Illnesses can be cured. Illnesses can become better.
Yeah.
But you can't necessarily trust that situation in the heat of the emotion and the mental illness.
That's exactly right, Chief. And your predecessor over the Utah Chiefs of Police, Tom Ross, he used this term with me. He said, Steve, what we're really trying to do is we need an additional tool in the toolbox. We've got to reduce gun violence. We need an additional tool in the toolbox that's constitutionally protected, and that can work in these very exigent situations.
So
absolutely, I agree with that 100%. I have spoken with Chief Ross extensively about this in the past, and I think we're on the same page. I really do. We both have had to kind of come to our own conclusions.
Understand that, yeah.
How we feel that this is a necessary thing for law enforcement to be able to, temporarily separate that firearm from that person in some situations.
Carrie, did you have a final thought before we go to break?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to talk about some of the fears that people have about this. I think Chief Ross mentioned that it's kind of controversial, and we want to make sure that there is due process. And I think that Utah has the opportunity to do things a little bit differently so that this is really narrowly targeted to these people who are in most exigent circumstances, who are in most crisis, who are most likely to do the largest amount of damage with this firearm. And I think that Representative Handy has done a really good job working with the community and stakeholders to make sure that this bill includes due process, such as high evidentiary standards, and a limited number of petitioners.
And a false claim. A person brings a false claim is subject to a third-degree felony charge.
Right, right. So I think people are afraid that you're going to cut a guy off on the freeway and he's going to call and say, this guy's a nut and I want his guns taken away.
No, it's not what this
is. That can't happen per the law. Number one, it's a limited number of petitioners. It has to be somebody who has firsthand knowledge of this, and then they have to be able to present that evidence to a judge prior to any intervention happening. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we're just going to be the Wild West of gun grabbing.
Well,
here.
At least
it's
gonna
be very
limited. At least it gives you an option, because I know as a family member who's dealt with people who are depressed or in distress, mm-hmm. and I'm in a veterans group where sometimes you run into this. It is the worst thing in the world to feel like you don't have any options.
Right.
Like there's nothing short of asking the police to lock them up or driving them up to uni on their own.
Well, what a great discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
Carol,
both of you, for joining us.
We'll be talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Chief Giles.
You're listening to KSL Radio. When we come back, we're going to talk about Pearl Harbor and why do we mark these sad but significant anniversaries for our country. Welcome back to KSL Radio. You are listening to Amy Donaldson from the Deseret News.
And Steve Handy. Happy to be here with you, Amy, again.
Yes. Yeah. It's fun. This may be our...
Swan song.
Swan song or like a temporary break, right? So maybe they'll still ask us to fill in on vacations and such. But you are going to be hearing a couple more episodes of Doug, right? You lucky people. And then on Wednesday, you get a brand new show with Lee Lonsberry that should be really exciting.
Really exciting.
Really looking forward to that. If you want to join the conversation, please, please do. You can join us on the text line, the Utah Community Credit Union text line. That number is 57500. We may read your thoughts on air. If you ask a question, we're happy to answer that. I'm very excited about our next segment. We're going to talk to Dr. John Reed. He's a University of Utah history professor. We're going to talk about tomorrow is the 78th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Right. And as you know, Amy, as they give us these kind of a blank space, and they say, what are your ideas? Fill it in here. And I started working on this yesterday, and you did too. We had some thoughts back and forth, and I realized December 7th is coming up, and I was at Pearl Harbor in early October, had an opportunity to go there. And
Was that your first trip there?
It was my second trip. Very somber. Very somber. I spent a lot of time, reading and thinking and looking at things and talking to people. It was, you go out there over the Arizona, and it's very, very moving. So I thought it would be interesting to talk about this, but not in terms of the attack and everything like that, but just I've reached out to some contacts in the history community, and they put us in touch with Dr. Reed. Are you there, Dr. Reed?
I am.
Terrific. And what I was thinking about is, and I know that Bo talked to you from Fort Douglas about the context of how did America get the news? No Twitter, no Facebook, no. How did they get the news? What were those reactions? What happened after that occurrence on December 7th, 1941?
Well, of course, there was no television.
Right.
The telegraph, didn't operate as a mass media information system. And so people got it on the radio, and in some places sort of back channel messages leaked out. But basically most radio stations would play the official War Department announcements. And initially, of course, it was just that there was an attack, and it wasn't even specified that it was carrier aircraft. So a lot of people were very puzzled about how the Japanese could get from the home islands of Japan all the way to the Hawaiian Islands. And then later, as people in D.C. themselves were briefed on the losses, then information was released on, more or less the gravity of the situation. They couldn't, list and specify that this ship or that ship was in this or that state of damage, because obviously it would be giving the Japanese information on the success of their attack. But within a few days, at least, people understood that it was a pretty grave event and that it placed a really serious disadvantage on us, because the battleship fleet was what people thought were going to be going across the Pacific to even up the score. And that battleship fleet was unavailable for several years after the attack.
Yeah, it was basically destroyed. But the carrier fleet was away, mm-hmm. and yeah.
So one thing that I wondered about was, Hawaii wasn't even a state when the attack occurred. What did people even know on the mainland? Because I grew up in Alaska, and I know a lot of people in the 80s didn't know much about my home state. But what was sort of the feeling about Hawaii?
I think Hawaii was, with all due respect, and I myself lived in Alaska for a couple of years in the Army, but I think people knew a lot more about Hawaii than they did about Alaska. And, the National Geographic would help out with that. The Matson Line, zipped back and forth between San Francisco and Hawaii. The Lurline was the beautiful big twin or triple funneled liner, that took vacationers there. I think people knew a lot, actually, and that would, of course, contribute to the shock, because not only was Hawaii a beautiful place to go and vacation, but it was also the front line of defense for North America, at least in the Pacific.
Let me share with the two of you and our listeners a quick story from my life. So my own father, now passed, George Handy, he had just started his LDS mission in Portland. He'd taken the train to Portland. He got there in November. He told us that they were setting up chairs on December 7th, Sunday morning. They were setting up chairs for their meetings. Someone came running in and said, "The Japanese have just attacked Pearl Harbor." My dad said later in life, he said at the time to them, he had two questions. Why would they do that, and where is Pearl Harbor? He said we were so naive. We had no idea of world things happening in the world. We had no idea. So that was his experience.
Interesting. Why do you think it's important for us to sort of talk about these historic events and how they relate today?
Like, and maybe compare and contrast it to
9/11.
To 9/11.
Right. And so the general rubric under which that's discussed is the idea of the, quote, intelligence failure, unquote, and which has many components. First, you have to you have to gather raw intelligence, and then you have to process it to figure out what it means, and then you have to figure out who needs to get it within the defense establishment or the national security establishment. And I think, you know, I am not at all well-versed on the 9/11 controversy, but at least from the surface, you would have to say that, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, World War II, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, all appear to be failures of the correct interpretation of information that you do have in your possession but haven't quite yet processed and disseminated.
Your perspective as a history professor, we really appreciate it.
Really, thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Reed.
We're going to step aside, and when we come back, we're going to have a few more thoughts on Pearl Harbor.
We'll talk
and
about it
and also, I just visited Topaz, so we'll have a little discussion there. Please feel free to weigh in on the text line, 57500. You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. I'm Amy Donaldson, alongside
and, Steve Handy. Here
Steve
we
Handy.
Are.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. I wanted to read that Governor Gary Herbert has issued the following statement. It has been 78 years since Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. On that day, our nation lost over 2,400 service members and nearly 1,200 were wounded. Even in the horror of that unexpected raid, those stationed at Pearl Harbor fought back in defense of our nation and our freedoms. On this day, just tomorrow, I guess, right?
Maybe tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
We look back with humility and gratitude and remember the countless sacrifices of the greatest generation who rose at every occasion and gave of themselves at every turn so that our nation might emerge victorious from the Second World War. May we never forget them. And he encourages all individuals, businesses, schools, and groups to fly the flags at half staff, and all state facilities will be at half staff for the entirety of the day from midnight until midnight on Saturday, December 7th.
It's a very nice statement.
It is a really nice
statement.
And I think it's a good reminder, I think, because we forget how many people were killed. Now, both of us have been to the monument there in Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember it being such a contrast. You're in Hawaii. I mean, I don't know if your family was like my family. We're like going to luau's and we're on the beach and we're doing all this fun stuff. And then we spend the day at the Pearl Harbor Museum and then go out to the Arizona, which is, you know, it is a grave site.
Very right? sobering. Right?
Yeah. It and is. It is just a reminder in a way that you know, you understand things intellectually, but then you have this emotional connection.
Right.
It's so profound.
Right.
I think it completely changed my feeling about that. I felt like I had a personal connection to it. And it was the reason that I wanted to see Topaz. Which is where Japanese were interned in Delta, Utah. And if you haven't been to the museum down there, it's amazing. You can actually also go see, they took buildings from the internment camp and used them as buildings around town. And they have a little map where you can drive around and see which buildings were reused and which ones were just torn down. Not much out at the actual campsite. It to me, was a really fascinating and I guess a warning about how fear can override our we are people, you know, and I've traveled, you've traveled. We love freedom more than almost anything. Like, it is just the number one thing. But it is a reminder that when you're afraid, you will willingly give somebody the keys to your free house, right? And we allowed some things to happen that I hope we never do again. But sometimes I wonder. I hear conversations here and there. My husband has been for 20 years talking about the erosion of our civil liberties, specifically our right to privacy.
And he's a lawyer, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think that especially with the proliferation of tech, you know, I think I have friends who say, "Well, we don't have any privacy," and I'm just gonna, you know, resign myself to that fact. And I would say, don't resign yourself to giving up anything you don't have to give up.
Oh, constant. It requires constant vigilance. And let me talk about this but this a little bit where you've gone here, Amy, and that is that this was a horrific, of all of the great things, and the United States comes together and everything, horrific black eye, I think, on our country that Franklin Roosevelt issued this infamous order on these these Japanese that were not spies. They were Americans, And I mentioned in the previous segment experience of my father, but my own mother told us that she grew up here in Salt Lake City. So she was 15 in 1941. She was 15 years old, was going down to West High here just down the street. And she said that they remember a little friend of theirs, Japanese friend. And one day she was just not in class anymore. And they totally lost track of her, and she and her family were interred. And that is horrific. Now, it's now, you know, people go back into the times and they say, you don't know what that was like. But we have the perspective that we can look at it, like Dr. Reed, our history professor just now, with the perspective of these 78 years. And that's an incredible stain and an embarrassment on America. I've studied a lot the World War One, and there was tremendous prejudice against Germans of Americans of German descent. We had a huge population here in the state of Utah, huge problems. But with the Japanese, because of different, you know,
well, they look different. That's the biggest thing.
That's it. They look different. So you know,
yeah,
horrific. But
and I think the thing that was appalling, I guess, to go down there and when you're reading these accounts of individual families, and a lot of families have donated personal items to the museum down there, including letters and wedding dresses and things like that. A lot of those people felt like they did not have a choice. They had to give a loyalty oath, and that sometimes required their children to serve in the military. And how would you like to be serving in the military and have your family be interned?
Incredible. And there was this
prisoner. And some of them wanted to, they were willing to go. And some of them did it because they felt like their families would be better off if they did serve. So it was, I just think it was just a horrific time in our history. And I think we'd be smart to remember something Benjamin Franklin said: those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And I would take it one step farther and say, you get neither liberty nor safety. And that's really, for me, that's one of the reasons I love. My husband's a huge history buff, and we always make it a point to go to historical museums of any kind. I loved, even when I was traveling cross country, I went to the little museum in Illinois right across from Carthage Jail. Not practicing LDS, but yeah. I found the articles about Joseph Smith and the Mormons to be incredibly bigoted, is the only way I can say.
Yeah, they were horrendously.
Well, I'm reading them thinking, this, like, people talk about fake news, you know?
How did this happen?
Yeah, but it gave me some idea about what they were afraid of.
Yeah.
Because I had always heard about, you know, Joseph Smith encouraging people to become politically involved, which I think is a great thing. And you see that in our minority communities now, and refugee and immigrant populations. And you had people who didn't want that, who saw that as an attempt to take over our country, right? To infiltrate our country. And where it's really just a new citizen saying, hey, let's be a part of this new country. Let's participate in full. And you can kind of see how that fear gets, you know, twisted and used for a nefarious purpose. And I just think, always ask yourself, I mean, for me, I always go back to, like, am I afraid of something? Am I acting out of fear? Or am I acting out of, I feel like this is the best thing for us, or for me, or for the things I believe in? Because I think when you feel like you're acting out of fear, you're much more likely to do something you regret.
Yeah, that's exactly. It was a fearful time. It was a time of, what's next? There's going to be an invasion. And, you know, the Japanese did lob a few things at the West Coast. But there was a lot of fear. There were blackouts on the West Coast. We can't even comprehend and understand that. But the price of liberty is continued vigilance, and we have to be vigilant and think about these things. I really like what you said about, you know, where the harm, and what does it really do to me? Where am I?
Keep in mind, the courts actually supported the internment of our own citizens.
It was upheld. Unbelievably, it was upheld.
Yeah. And there are a number.
Constitutional,
my husband, challenges. Could rattle off a whole bunch of court cases in which you would say that was an injustice, but the courts said that was okay. And I think that just goes to show you, there isn't any one aspect of our government or of our public life that's infallible.
Yeah.
And we just have to hope and work towards being, you know, riding the ship if we get off track. And Somebody points out that George Takei of Star Trek was interned at one of the Utah Japanese camps. I thought there was only Topaz, but was there a second?
There was only Topaz too, but somebody will correct us on that.
I know there were some throughout the deserty parts of the West, but I mean, the thing that was really sad is that
Idaho.
Some of these people had businesses and they never got those businesses back. And I remember reading Maya Angelou talking about how some of those businesses were just given to other people. And, you know, they left. And so then there was a store. Oh, okay, you want the store? You can have the store.
Yeah, I think the message here is, remember Pearl Harbor, but also remember some of the injustices, the social injustices that came as a result of the war effort that were overreactions that we look at today, 78 years later.
Yeah,
overreactions,
I think
violation of personal rights.
Yeah, remember the overall lessons of something like that. Because being attacked makes you feel so vulnerable. I loved the way we responded after 9/11. I felt so proud to be an American. You remember the Olympics.
I remember.
And
yeah.
It was the one time I thought nothing can divide us. I pity anyone who tries to attack us. I felt like we were invincible, right? Even though I felt super vulnerable about the attack, I felt like we as human beings as American citizens had come together and we were willing to take care. Now, there were some horrific things that happened.
Absolutely.
To Muslim people in our in different communities.
Absolutely.
But by and large, people were nicer to each other. They were, you know, more careful. And so I think that it's just always important to remember, like, there are lots of lessons to be learned from these things. History is constantly providing us with perspective and insight, and we would be wise to listen to it.
We would be wise to listen. The final thing I want to say is that after this great discussion that we've been having, hopefully listeners have been paying attention, that is that I'm in a little plug here. The movie out Midway is playing right now. The first of the movie starts with the attack on Pearl Harbor. And I like the movie a lot. Yeah, the dialogue's a little cheesy and things like that. But it is really a great Hollywood blockbuster. And so if you want to kind of get some feeling for this, go see that movie. But don't forget the other important things, the deeper things that we've been talking about here, the unintended consequences.
Yes. Don't be afraid. Be bold. Be Americans. You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. Dance party. That was good music. I like that.
You were doing it, Amy. Hey, I'm Steve Handy.
I was wiggling. I'm not sure
Steve
what
Handy
that is.
Steve Handy with Amy today.
I'm also excited about this topic. We're going to talk about Logan just became Utah's third city to ban plastic bags. We're going to have City Councilman Herm Olson's going to join us. Herm, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Thank you so much for making time. We really appreciate it. I'm very curious about this, like this idea that you would do individually, like we're asked to do individually to help the clean air situation. And I'm sort of wondering what's the thinking behind Logan City saying we're going to ban plastic bags and sort of how would that work? How would the ban work?
Well, that's a fair question. And part of the answer lies in Salt Lake. I remember some years ago, driving from the airport back up to Logan and passing the Salt Lake County landfill, I noticed that the fence was absolutely pestered with single-use bags and plastic and just debris that had blown in and lodged into the fence. And I realized we had that very same problem up in Cache County. On a windy day, when the garbage trucks are out collecting trash, those single-use plastic bags particularly will blow out of the cans before they even hit the bed of the truck, and they end up in our gutters and our roads and our trees and our canals, and it's just a mess. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that plastic is permanent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't biodegrade. It will, over decades, break into what they call microplastics, but they then find their way into our water sources, into fish, birds, animal, food chain. This is ultimately not a good and healthy environment to sort of proliferate this plastic plague. And so I approached some merchants and found a lot of support from merchants about doing this. They spend thousands and in some cases tens of thousands of dollars a year in giving out free plastic bags because the community has a sort of entitlement sense about it. And so we thought, you know, we have gone generations without single-use plastic bags. Mm-hmm. We can get back to reusable bags, paper bags, biodegradable bags, and survive. So that was kind of the motive.
You know, Councilman Olson, this is Steve Handy. I serve in the legislature. We had a couple years ago a bill brought to have them have a statewide ban. But we felt like, and I felt like, that we ought to leave that up to each municipality, entity, government entity, to make that decision on their own. And Logan has come to that. Now, I read the story that it passed on a 3-2 3-2 vote. Is that correct? And how did that go down?
Although that's only part of the deal. Because,
okay.
We just immediately prior to the vote on the ban, we unanimously passed a resolution supporting a countywide plastic reduction program.
Oh.
When we got into this, we realized that single-use plastic bags are a pesky nuisance, but there is a mountain of trash gathered every day, every week, by merchants who, when they receive their product, especially clothing merchants, every pair of socks they get, every pair of gloves, every shirt is packaged in plastic. And so single-use bags distributed by merchants is important in solving the problem. But if we could address the proper collection and recycling and disposal of this massive plastic problem on a countywide basis, that's the route we want to go. So Logan has proposed a countywide plastic reduction program, which we intend to implement in March. And if we do that, then frankly there won't be a need for the single-use plastic bag ban, because merchants would then make a choice of whether they would continue to distribute single-use bags, but require every customer to pay 10 cents a bag for that which they are receiving. And if they choose not to distribute plastic bags, then fine. They don't have to worry about it. But they will have a surcharge imposed. Merchants which then say we still want to use plastic bags will have a surcharge added to their environmental waste bill every month as a price for polluting. And so if we can do this countywide, it will help the whole community, not just Logan, and we won't need to worry about a ban for Logan.
So let me ask you this. I actually think this is a great idea. I loved what you said about it being symbolic. Somebody saying that maybe it was symbolic, but you were saying symbols are important. Like, it's important to make a statement and to take a stand at some point. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say if you want to use a single, like you said, for generations we were getting along fine. And then somehow in the 70s and 80s, we decided we need individual plastic bags for everything. But how realistic do you think it is that the county will deal with that? And would it be helpful if you got a symbolic gesture from the state level on this?
Well, yeah, it would be huge. And Steve's comment about the view about a statewide proposal, that can be important. But I very much liked his notion that each county and each city should make this decision on its own. You know, for years, for decades, the Utah legislature has moaned and groaned about the big bad bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. making decisions for Utah that maybe weren't Utah-specific. Well, that's the problem. If the legislature then tries to impose rules on a municipality to solve local problems. And so I appreciated Steve's thought about that, because each community should determine. And the whole premise of this is that we are stewards of our environment. And we should not, we can do a better job. We shouldn't be content to make a mess in our own bed. And happily, Logan has determined that we need to do better. We can do better. It's a statement for our community today and for our kids and our grandkids. And so, you know, I'm pleased that the council agreed to both support the resolution unanimously and then by a close margin to approve the ban. And frankly, if we do adopt this countywide approach, we'll likely rescind the ban because it would then no longer be necessary.
We're at the end of this, Councilman Olson, but I would, very articulate, terrific. Hey, I want to suggest you might want to run for office. Congratulations on this initiative, and we're excited to see where it goes. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. You're listening to Amy Donaldson from the Deseret News.
And State Representative Steve Handy, co-hosting today with Amy.
Yes, or we're co-hosting with you. We're not sure which is the lead dancer here.
Well, I told you, you're in first chair.
Okay.
You're in first chair.
That means I get to lead. Yay. I love being in charge. So, you are letting me lead on this next issue.
Yeah.
We wanted to talk about, I read this article about Intermountain Healthcare sponsoring the National Football League's Oakland Raiders after they moved to Las Vegas. The Raiders announced Wednesday that the nonprofit healthcare conglomerate will retain naming rights for the Henderson, Nevada Performance and Training Center, and is goes on and on about what that relationship is, where it is. There's a really beautiful artist rendering of what this facility will look like, and this just rubbed me the wrong way.
Fingernails on a chalkboard.
Yes, and partly because I am tired of most of our healthcare debate is about insurance coverage. Do people have access to insurance coverage? And I think we need to shift that discussion to, do people actually have access to healthcare? Can I go to a doctor? And I don't know if Robin is listening in, if she wants to come in and talk about her dentist experience, but I had the experience of my daughter moving out of state, and I call our insurance company here at DMBA, here at Deseret News, and ask them, how do I find a provider for her, you know, because she's covered under my insurance. And they tell me, here's how you do it. And I come up with a grand total of six doctors for her to choose from. Not a huge selection, but at least there's a doctor to go to. When it comes to mental health providers, none. So there's nobody there for her to go to that's covered under our medical plan. And I just think that for a long time, medical or health insurance companies would tell you what you could and couldn't do, what was and wasn't covered. Robin just had a fabulous trip to the dentist.
Robin, our producer.
I did. I know. I've been talking with Doug about it all week. It's become Toothgate around here. Yeah. You know, it's a tragedy when December hits and stuff happens because, you know, out-of-pocket max runs out, all of this. And so I won't go into too much detail in case there was some, I don't know what you'd call it, under-the-table stuff happening. But the way that they billed me for this procedure today will very much work in my favor for insurance purposes.
But you were planning on spending
$1,000 today.
$1,000 today, because you've maxed out on your dental bill.
They're essentially going to do it in two visits instead of doing it all in one visit, so that it will all be billed at a later date, which I think that's totally on the level.
Yeah.
But it saved me. I was shocked. I kind of walked out of there thinking, he just gave me a $1,000 gift card.
No, because but that's what we're reduced to. So you have a dentist who would work with you and figure out a way for your insurance to cover what is a serious medical need for you. And sometimes you get a doctor who's not willing to do that or who doesn't know. I know I've had issues with like a medicine that you need, a prescription. And by and large, most prescriptions are covered. But sometimes there's new medications that are not covered or they're just super expensive. And then it turns into this game of, Can you get a coupon? Is it cheaper?
Well, and it's just so arbitrary. My son's on. He has a chronic condition. And he takes medication every day. We're dependent on it. It was $10 for years and years and years. We just switched insurance companies. It's $80 a month now. We don't know why it went from $10 to $80. Same medication, same dosage, same everything. Mm-hmm. Just a different plan, different coverage. And my husband's been really diligent about calling the company and trying to get it down. That's not going to break the bank. People have way more. I mean, $80 still is a lot, but it's not. I've heard of $5,000 a month for insulin.
Well, we had one medication for my daughter that was $300-something. And I just thought, this is like a car payment, right? And I don't know how you would do it. Like, there's a time in my life where I couldn't have done that.
Right.
So that's why I see this, and I see, I read about them purchasing, healthcare partners, which is what takes them into the Las Vegas area, right? Takes them outside of Utah a little bit more. And I'm all for expanding networks because I feel like your insurance should cover you wherever you live, right? You should be able to go and use it in the same way someone uses Medicare or Medicaid, but that's not the way it works. They have to negotiate these deals with doctors, and that's why you can only see certain doctors. And I think until we shift our conversation and revamp the system so that I get to call up and say, hey, how much does it cost to get a tooth filled or a cavity filled, right? Actually, a dentist will actually tell you. But if you call for a medical procedure, I called 1 year for a mammogram, and they just wouldn't tell me what it cost.
That's not right.
You know? And I just thought I need to know because I have a high deductible.
Well, and a lot of times they don't even know at the doctor's office until they send it through insurance. Yeah. There is a podcast I listened to a long time ago about a doctor somewhere who is doing menued services somewhere out there. He's going back to kind of the pay per.
There's a few of those in Salt Lake and one in St. George.
I would be all for that.
You can just pay cash.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get rid of. So I looked at my premium this year per month and thought, I think I might want to move to that. It's gotten so much higher. And I'm basically a healthy person. I think I would rather, and then I can say, I want to spend my money on chiropractic, and your insurance company says that's not real medical care, right? So I think they shouldn't be making medical decisions for us. We should make the medical decisions, and they should just say, you know, if you pay for your insurance, this is what you get. This is what you get for that. But, you know, I don't, it just made me kind of sick to my stomach thinking, they're sponsoring an NFL team. How is this the way we want our healthcare providers going? Like, what direction are we headed when a nonprofit has the money to give to a football team? I don't know.
You know, and that's kind of was my reaction. I mean, my whole career has been spent in marketing and advertising, and so I get that. I don't get this thing because you and I talked about in the production pre-production meeting. And a nonprofit, and we're going to hear from Intermountain Healthcare, and that's fine.
Yeah,
but a nonprofit, mm-hmm. quote unquote, nonprofit.
This: how does this make their goal? Like they said, we believe in like being a partner and making the community healthier. How does it make the community healthier to sponsor an NFL team?
It seems like an odd fit, and I'm sure there's a good story here, but it seems like an odd fit that you and I are just talking about here, based upon a news story that we're reading and reacting to it.
Yeah. I mean, it was an announcement, I think it was yesterday or earlier today, and I just, we saw it kind of last minute, and I thought, oh, you've got to be kidding me. So
it got the hackles up, listeners.
It did. It made me angry because we've all fought with our insurance companies about things, right? And I just think, really? Like, I have to fight with you to get, you know, a blood test versus a biopsy, but you can sponsor an NFL team and that somehow I'm supposed to feel good about as a community member. Like I think there are 100,000 programs I could create for you that would make the community healthier. You want to sponsor, create a gym that people can go work out at for free in your communities, right?
They'll probably say we're doing that too, but it does seem like a real disconnect.
Really?
I
mean, where's the free
NFL
gym? If they're doing that already, tell me where the free gym is.
Yeah.
A. Donaldson at DeseretNews.com. Happy to know where the free gym is that's paid for by my health dollars.
Awesome.
So I'm getting off my soapbox. And you are free to text us about this issue on the Utah Community Credit Union text line.
Yeah.
57500.
How do you feel about Intermountain Healthcare?
Or any healthcare company.
Or any
a nonprofit.
Company. Yeah.
An
a
insurance
nonprofit.
Company.
Yeah.
You know, being sponsoring teams and stuff like that. So
that's right.
You're listening to KSL Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. This is Amy Donaldson from the Deseret News alongside my friend Steve Handy.
Yeah, Steve Handy. Here I am.
Steve Handy of legislative fame and formerly of the Deseret News.
Yes. We worked together years ago, didn't we? It was a good time.
Yeah. So let's talk about our next topic is this amazing program that the Red Cross has where they help people who can't afford it or don't have access to smoke detectors. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Smoke detectors, fire alarms. And I know a little bit about this. I served 9 years on the Red Cross board. And a few years ago, they asked me to sponsor what's called a request for an appropriation. So we requested from the legislature a one-time appropriation. It was $100,000 that then they used to buy smoke alarms. Then they brought together volunteers and they sent them into areas. You know, I mean, these are it's amazing when you think about there are lots of homes that do not have a smoke alarm, a working smoke alarm. And if you just had something like that, you could save property and lives. And the initiative is called Cause for Alarms.
Well, and the interesting thing is that they actually recommend smoke detectors in every bedroom.
Yeah.
And like on every level. So if you have a 2-level house, one on the top, one on the bottom. I know my smoke detectors, I don't pay much attention to them until the batteries go out.
Chirp, 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 chirp.
They chirp at me and my dogs hide. So it encourages me to keep up on the battery changes. But you do sleep a little better, right? Knowing that when we remodeled our house, before our remodel in 2009, we did not have smoke detectors in every bedroom. We had one on each level. So we had 2 smoke detectors in about 2,000 square feet.
Yeah.
Right? And that if the fire starts near the smoke detector, you're fine. But if it starts in a bedroom, which is much more likely, then, you just get less time. And my fear was my children were young and I have dogs and a cat and they would hide. And that was I thought, if you have these alarms going off in every room, they're going to come to me.
They're going to come to you. Well, this is a tremendous initiative. And we have Rich Woodruff, the communications director for the Red Cross of Utah, on the line. And he's going to tell us about some things. And Rich and I worked together a few years ago where we had a volunteer youth group and we were out installing these. And it was an incredible eye-opening experience for the youth. And you've been on a lot of these, Rich. But tell us about is it still called Cause for Alarm? Is that what it's still called, Rich?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. No, it's great to be on your show today on KSL. The event, the big installation event here in Ogden was a Cause for Alarm, and that was sort of a subtitle of the bigger Sound the Alarm in the Home Fire campaign. So, this is a big deal for the Red Cross. This is a big initiative that was actually launched back in October of 2014. And a lot of people may not know of all the disasters, 64,000 disasters the Red Cross responds to every year. The number one disaster, it's not floods, hurricanes, wildfires, et cetera. It is home fire. And a couple of things we know about home fire is that, sadly, about 7 people a day perish in a home fire. And usually because of non-working smoke alarms or no smoke alarms. And so the Red Cross said, okay, we're going to go ahead. We're going to do an initiative. We know that the smoke alarms cut the risk of dying in the home fire by 50%. So let's do a campaign where our goal is to reduce deaths from home fires by 25%. So fast forward to right now, at last count, after nearly 2 million smoke alarms nationwide installed, we've tracked about 642 lives have been saved as a direct result. So the campaign is working, and the event that you alluded to is a good example of when we do our big annual push in the spring where we call it Sound the Alarm. And it's a concentrated effort that we have 100 target cities, and the goal is to get 100,000 alarms installed and get families safer within that concentrated period of time. So what you contributed with your group was toward that goal, and it makes a huge impact. So it's a great program. It's an important part of the Red Cross culture of preparedness, And it's a real tangible way to involve the public, too, both financially and volunteering for the events. So
those statistics are amazing and incredibly compelling. And I've been working with two of your colleagues, Aaron and Ben, and we're going to take another run at it when the legislative session starts in January in 2020 to get some additional appropriations so that this great
AKA
initiative
money.
Can continue, a.k.a. money,
yes.
That this initiative can continue. What do you think, Amy?
Well, I think how do people because I know people who would say I don't qualify, or they live in an apartment and their landlord won't pay for smoke detectors. And I just wondered, like, what are the parameters for this to qualify? Like, what do you do if you feel like?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah. What we do is we study and we know where there's a higher propensity for home fires or multifamily like apartments and such. And so we determine these, they're more at risk neighborhoods. A lot of them are rental properties. A lot of them are apartment buildings. And so what we do is we canvass those neighborhoods and
the volunteers knock on doors.
Knock on doors, door to door. Or we'll leave a door hanger if no one's home. Say, hey, we're coming to your neighborhood on this day, and no strings attached, no obligation, no cost. We would like to come in and install up to 3 alarms. We recommend 1 per floor. So, and the other thing, a real important part of it is the educational piece. So it's educating families. So you have the alarm, you have the education. And what we do is we sit down during that visit and while installing the alarms and teach them evacuation plans. You know, we actually have a grid that they draw out a plan and they practice it a couple of times a year. And then, of course, making sure the alarms are functioning, test the batteries, make sure they're in good working order. So the alarm, the education in those areas, it makes a big difference. It's important to note as well that the sound alarm installations do take place year-round. You know,
mm-hmm.
People want
right.
to call and get an alarm installed or 2 or 3, whatever they need. We can do that as well. So it's an ongoing campaign, and that's kind of how it works.
Do you tend to respond to more of these emergencies in the winter, or is there a season that is higher than others?
Big spike in the winter. Yep. You'll see in the news. I just saw a story of a fire that was caused by electrical short. You know, you got holiday decorating. You've got cooking fires, the number one cause of home fire. A lot of cooking going on in the wintertime, a lot of space heaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we get a big spike.
This is a time of higher risk. And, of course, us Utahns, in our mind, the 20 years ago or so forth, the Christmas tree at the governor's mansion burned.
Yeah, I do remember that.
You know,
I do think one thing that's important for people to understand is that the reason that these alarms are so critical is because a lot of people actually die because they suffer smoke inhalation.
Yeah.
And then they're just not able to get out.
That's correct. Yeah, another misconception. People don't realize that, you know, in a home fire, you only have about 2 minutes to escape. They think it's a lot longer, you know.
Oh, I didn't
and
know that.
So, and a lot of them are overnight. The alarm goes off. The evacuation plan kicks in. You know, they have a couple of different routes to escape. But it can happen very quickly. And, you know, we had a fatality, I think, last week. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Kaysville. There's a textbook example. They're deadly. And
well,
having the alarm working, having the plan, it makes a big difference.
This is amazing. The Red Cross is an amazing organization, always there providing shelter and help and assistance when these home fires, these unfortunate home fires occur. And I'm really excited to
and it's also
go
wonderful
forth
service.
With this initiative, and we're going to get this done.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful service, especially, I mean, I was a single mom when I was trying to install my fire detector. And God bless the fire department in my neighborhood, because they came over and helped me with it, because I thought I can just, you know, screw it into the wall, but I don't know if I was doing it right. And now they have those ones that actually they look for smoke or electrical, you know, they're very complicated. It's not just like it used to be, you threw a battery in it and screwed it to the wall. So I just think that there are a lot of people who just need a little bit of assistance putting it in the right spot or finding the right, alarm to be installing in your house.
And for the volunteers, it's so gratifying for the volunteers that the Red Cross mobilizes to go canvas, as you said, Rich, and to see these situations where they're going, wow, people they don't have a smoke alarm? And mm-hmm. they're very appreciative to have this done. And so keep up the great good work, Rich, and we'll see as we get
into the
next
year. Thank you for doing this. Is there a website people can go to get more information on this program?
Yeah, absolutely. Redcross.org. you can go through that portal. There's also a designated site called soundthealarm.org, and that's very specific to this campaign. So two ways the audience, your audience can participate. You can either sign up to volunteer as we get to the events, or you can donate money. And Steve, as you mentioned, getting some legislative appropriation toward this, that makes a big difference. Because, you know, we got to buy these alarms. Some are donated, but it costs money. And having that funding makes a big difference.
Thanks for your efforts, Rich. Great to talk to you. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the Utes. After this break, we're going to talk to my friend Dirk Facer.
Utah versus Oregon.
About
Utah
and Oregon game. You are listening to KSL News Radio. Welcome back to KSL Radio. This is Amy Donaldson alongside Steve Handy.
Yes, hello.
I'm so excited we get to talk to my former sports colleague, Dirk Facer. Dirk, can you hear us?
I can hear you. How are you guys?
Yeah, hello, Dirk, and my former colleague and buddy, too, Dirk.
Dirk Facer's everybody's buddy.
Dirk.
We're Davis County brothers.
Yeah, that's exactly right, true. Dirk. That's right, man.
So you're down in Santa Clara. How is the weather, by the way? I heard it was cold.
Yeah, it's supposed to be rainy.
It's a little cold. You know, they were predicting wind and rain, and right now the cloud, it hasn't rained today, but the clouds are getting dark, and not too windy yet. So I heard one person tell me that they thought the weather might hold off till later in the game rather than starting with the rain right when kickoff. That was the original forecast, but we'll see. But right now, a little chilly and very dark clouds over the stadium. I hope that's not a bad omen.
So, Dirk, this game would have massive implications anyway because it's for the championship. Utah played last year. They played Washington and lost 10-3. But they're back in the game, so obviously that's motivation enough. But just kind of explain a little bit about what hangs in the balance for Utah if they end up being successful in this game against Oregon today.
Well, you know, the Utes are number 5 in the college football playoff rankings. The top 4 teams go to the semifinals, so they're one spot out of being in the national semifinals, and that's decided by a committee of 13 people. And they're going to meet and make their final selections on Sunday. If Utah wins, the kind of the prevailing thought is, and LSU beats Georgia in the SEC championship game, Georgia is currently number 4. That would conceivably open the door for Utah to slide into one of those 4 spots. As a consolation prize, the winner of this game, if Oregon wins, they're going to the Rose Bowl. And at the very least, Utah would be making a first-ever trip to the Rose Bowl if the college football playoff thing doesn't materialize. So the Utes have a lot of things weighing on this. It's kind of reminiscent of 2004 Fiesta Bowl and 2008 Sugar Bowl seasons. And, it's taken a while for them to, as Kyle Whittingham said, scale the Grand Canyon and jumping from the Mountain West to the Pac-12. But 2 years in a row they're here, like you mentioned, and now they've got an opportunity. They're favored to win this game. So
hey, Dirk, here's my question for you. This is kind of interesting. Amy was there covering last year, and you were there covering last year, I assume. And I was there with my family, and it was cold in that stadium, and it's a gorgeous, you know, where the 49ers play stadium. It's really, really great.
Right.
But that was a funky game last year. That was very, very strange, but that's ancient history. But you're around these guys all the time. Do you sense a difference? Compare and contrast this, the feelings you're getting as a unbiased sports writer looking at this year's team as opposed to the 2018 team on the
right.
Just on the verge of this game. Does that make sense? Is there a sense that
you're seeing? Yeah, it does. And, you know, Steve, the interesting thing is, you know, there are 4 or 5 seniors like Bradley and I, Julian Blackman, guys like that, that, like you folks here, that came back specifically to take care of what they called unfinished business. Mm-hmm. So there was a determination that is different with this team compared to last year. But, you know, ironically, you know, as great a season as Utah had, they had to win their last 8 games in a row just to get here after losing that Pac-12 opener to USC. And it's ironic you're having such a, you know, historic season, but it took an 8-game winning streak to get here. And, you know, conceivably, Steve, as coaches say, every game after that USC game was a championship game, because if they had lost one of those, they wouldn't be here today.
And, Dirk, I think it's important to remind everyone what the Utes were playing without last year, because Huntley was hurt, right? Zach Moss was hurt. Who else? Who else do you remember that was out during that game last year?
Britton Covey.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were really shorthanded, and but you know that was a fluky touchdown that they lost the game
on.
Mm-hmm. And in these games are, you know, the margin of error is thin. But I think Utah's defense is stronger this year, and I think, like you said, full strength, especially on offense. Obviously, Britton Covey isn't going to play again this year in the championship game, or he got hurt in last year's game. But you know. Having Tyler Huntley and Zach Moss playing at such a high level now, I don't think we'll see Utah just put 3 points on the board.
Yeah, I think you might see something different there. Also, I think Kyle Whittingham is a master at making the guys feel underestimated and overlooked, but he didn't really have to try that hard, right?
Yeah, well, you know, Paul Feinbaum with his comments this week and that, and, you know, obviously – Utah still has a ways to go, and that's going to be the interesting thing about the rankings this week, guys, because Oklahoma is slowly kind of inching their way up, you know, right behind Utah. It'll be interesting to see if the committee, if Oklahoma were to beat Baylor in the Big 12 championship game, would they say that is, you know, has more weight than Utah beating an Oregon team that's ranked in the teens?
Gotcha.
You know, because obviously the other game would be a top two, top seven teams. So,
I guess just winning is not going to be enough.
I'm sorry, what?
Just winning is not going to be enough.
You know, it should be, I guess, in a perfect world. But you know, this is kind of a beauty contest. It's really not a comprehensive ranking thing that you put in the computer and spits out answers. It's kind of the eye test, and that's why. You know, Kyle Whittingham's opposed to style points, but a lot of people are thinking they need to win impressively to send a message. But, you know, I looked up since they started this in 2014, the college football playoff. In the first year of it, TCU went into the final. You know, the Big 12 didn't have a championship game that year, but TCU was number three with a 10-1 record. And then they went in and they beat, I think it was Kansas. Whoever they beat them 55-3 in the last game of the season, and they fell from third to sixth in the final ranking. So, I don't know what's enough. You know, it's really it's really hard to predict. But a conference championship carries extra weight, and you know that should help Utah's cause. But who knows? You know, I thought the thing was corrupt when they only put four teams in to start with. I think it should have been eight. You know, the five. Power Five champions, and then, you know, maybe a group of five team and then two wild cards. But, you know, I think the SEC got what they wanted, and every year it seems like there's an argument to put two of their teams in.
Do you have a final question, Amy?
I just want you just like in 30 seconds to give me just some final thought on the team. You've watched the team all season. What do you think of this team?
You know, Amy, and you've been around them last year. Now, this is a very likable team. These are good kids. They work hard. They're respectful, and you know, Tyler Huntley gives a short answer sometimes, but he does so with a smile, and I think these guys are genuinely having fun, and you know, Coach Witt is having fun, and it shows when we go to practice and talking to the guys. So likable bunch, and I think even fans who favor the blue should have something to cheer for.
They're jumping on board. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us and making time, Dirk. We really appreciate it. You're listening to KSL Radio.
You guys.